from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. economy is a big ship. Donald Trump has promised to put it into high gear. Now he's president-elect with big expectations stoked by months of high-volume campaigning. So what is the Trump economic rollout likely to look like when he takes office, and what are the implications? This hour on Point, the economy and Donald Trump on his way to the White House. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you expecting from a Trump economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was Donald Trump on the stump in September, Economic Club of New York, outlining a plan for jobs, jobs, jobs.
If we lower our taxes, remove destructive regulations, and we have to do that, unleash the vast treasure of American energy, and negotiate trade deals that put America first, then there is no limit to the number of jobs we can create and the amount of prosperity we can unleash.
And more, much more.
We will put new American metal and new American steel into the spine of this country. Jobs will return, incomes will rise, new factories will come rushing back to our shores.
All right, how's that going to work? Let's dive in. First with us today from Washington is Neil Irwin. He's senior economic correspondent at the New York Times. He's been writing about what the U.S. economy might look like under a Trump presidency. Neil Irwin, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What's the heart of it?
Well, as with many things on with Trump, there's a lot we don't know. We're kind of trying to read the tea leaves between what he's said in his campaign speeches, the people he's surrounding himself with, the people who look like they might be appointed to important jobs. But the broad thrust, I think we do know, which is this. He wants to be much more aggressive on trade. He wants to refocus, renegotiate trade agreements in more favorable ways for the United States. He does want to do some kind of infrastructure push. He wants to build roads and bridges and have a set of spending priorities that try and boost America's infrastructure. He wants to cut taxes dramatically. He wants to cut taxes on business. He wants to cut taxes on all Americans, but with the highest, the largest tax cuts for the wealthy. And he wants to deregulate. He wants to do less regulation of banks, environmental regulation, all kinds of regulations that businesses complain about and say stop them from growing.
Let's start with infrastructure. This was a big, a lot of noise around infrastructure when President Obama took office in the depths of the recession 8 years ago now. On his election night or early morning the next day, his victory speech, Donald Trump went straight to infrastructure. Let's listen.
We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it.
Neil Irwin with the New York Times. All right, we heard this kind of language, what, 7, 8 years ago with President Obama. We didn't come out of that with roaring growth. Is the situation different now? Would Donald Trump do infrastructure differently than we've seen in the Obama administration? If so, how?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a very different economic moment than we were 8 years ago. Then we were in a deep recession, a deep crisis. Unemployment was skyrocketing. It would eventually hit 10%. So that was the case for the Obama stimulus back in the start of his administration. That did include a good bit of stimulus, though there was a big emphasis in that on remember the term of art at the time was shovel ready, things that could be done quickly. The idea was pump money into the economy very quickly, try and arrest the collapse that was underway. We're in a different moment. Unemployment's about 5%. So I think there are a lot of liberal economists and a lot of centrist economists who would say, yes, this is a good idea to take advantage of low interest rates to try and boost our national infrastructure. At the same time, it's not like there's the kind of low-hanging fruit that there was 8 years ago in terms of, you know, idle workers who can be put to work doing this stuff. So I think now there's more need to, if there's going to be this major investment that Trump is promising, to make sure it's done thoughtfully, to make sure the valuable projects are funded, because it's not as much of a free lunch as it would have been when unemployment was heading toward 10%.
What's his plan for financing infrastructure spending? Is it straight out of the federal budget, or he's got private financing that he's counting on with tax breaks? What's he got on the boards?
Yeah, people around him have talked about a kind of complex system where you use a tax credit to pull private funding into to fund projects. You know, you can design stuff like that that could be helpful and could generate some interesting projects. The problem is, you know, that requires that the project have some dedicated funding stream. So you can get private capital to work on infrastructure if it's a toll road, if it's a, you know, some discrete project that has a revenue flow that supports it. If you want to do stuff that's more kind of repairing bridges that are in disrepair or ordinary surface streets that are just all over the country, it's hard to figure out how you make private capital go to work because there's not that funding stream that can pay off investors who support it. So figuring that out will be a really interesting thing. Is this, assuming this becomes a legislative push in Congress, you know, is there a way that that the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress can be comfortable that this is, you know, a market-driven, private sector-driven thing, but also you know, in a way that is actually doing valuable projects and not just you know, major toll roads and bridges.
Sticking with the implications of infrastructure, first of all, do you think Congress would go with this? Republicans, can they do it alone? Will they get Democratic support for a big infrastructure push?
It depends on how it's designed, and it can cut either way. So I think Democrats will be reluctant to sign on to this part of the agenda if it is designed as purely something that kind of benefits private interests but not a broad push. On the other side, Republicans, you know, they've been a little chilly to this. Speaker Ryan, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, you know, they're not as enthusiastic. You know, they've had the opportunity. Barack Obama's been asking them for years to do a big infrastructure push, and they've not wanted to do it. So the question is there a pathway for the Trump administration to kind of get enough members of Congress on both sides to create a majority to push something through?
And how does that look? Are people looking at the deficit implications of this primarily, or what's the resistance?
Yeah, I mean, if you know, you could figure out ways to do it where it's deficit neutral. One thing that's been talked about is doing a corporate income tax reform that involves repatriation of billions of dollars that are overseas right now, and using that to fund kind of a one-time boost so that you don't blow out the deficit to do this. You know, if you do some of these things that involve private money, you can figure out ways to make it less impact on the deficit. But these things get complicated, and you know, it'll be interesting to see as the Trump administration gets into like actual policymaking and actually engaging with these trade-offs in the legislative process. Can they find a path forward? It'll be harder than I think some of them realize.
What about the jobs that Donald Trump, we just heard him say they would come rushing home, the factories and jobs. What lever do you pull to make that happen?
Well, you know, if you have a trillion dollars worth of roads and bridges being built, that creates construction jobs. We'll talk about
trade
in a minute.
But that's not manufacturing coming home, and that's not factories coming home.
Yeah, well, that gets into trade, and you know, if you believe that a more aggressive stance on trade and harder negotiating and all these things that Trump is promising will tilt the equation in favor of U.S. manufacturers, that could create some manufacturing jobs. That said, you know, the way Trump describes it, the idea that, you know, there's going to be all these steel jobs, the idea that there's going to be this, you know, massive rise in manufacturing employment, really it misses some of the reasons that the decline in manufacturing employment has happened. You know, what's happened during the same era? Globalization was happening, trade was rising, and at the same time, there were remarkable advances in manufacturing productivity, much more robotics, much more, you know, if you go to a factory floor these days, it's a modern factory, you'll see a handful of workers in this giant factory floor. You know, you can, even if you try and undo some of these trade relationships and make a more favorable balance of trade, it's hard to undo those. You're not going to undo those productivity gains. So, you know, the idea that there's going to be a massive rise in manufacturing jobs, it could happen, but it's going to be harder than some people think.
And what about net effect? We've got a lot to dig into here, and we will with Robert Scott and Peter Morici in just a moment. But what are people anticipating? I see in the markets today, you've got big roiling in bond markets, which indicate, I guess, people are worried about inflation and people are worried about higher interest rates. Or maybe those are welcome. The Fed has wanted higher inflation than we've had for a while.
Yeah, the irony of this is, you know, essentially Trump is proposing a version of Keynesian stimulus that a bunch of liberal economists have been wanting for years. He's proposing as we've been talking about, fiscal stimulus in the sense of infrastructure spending. He's proposing tax cuts. Those things would tend to blow out the deficit, but they could kind of jolt our economy into this an equilibrium where interest rates are higher, inflation's higher. And that might sound bad, and it could be if it goes too far, but that's actually what we've been wanting for years. You know, interest rates have been extraordinarily low. We've had inflation below the 2% that the Federal Reserve aims for. So what might happen is kind of a jolting out of that secular stagnation, some people call it, that has really been haunting the U.S. economy for years. I don't think it's the way most liberal economists would prefer to get there, but it's a real possibility. And that's to some degree, that's what markets are pricing in with, as you say, the drop in bond prices and the rally in stocks.
So lots of details to be fleshed out, and we'll go there. But as economists look at this, the broad approach, and we'll see what that is, but how do they see opportunity here? How do they see risk?
Well, you know, the way I think of it is there are things that Trump is proposing that would be good for short-term growth and short-term economic activity, short-term corporate profits, and there are things that would be bad. So the good things, infrastructure spending, tax cuts, deregulation. If you're a shareholder of a company, those are things you like to see. The other set of things are worse for the corporate environment. You know, if there's a trade war with 45% tariffs on China, that would, you know, be disruptive to a lot of trade flows, to a lot of companies' business models. You know, if you're Apple and you're making iPhones in China, suddenly massive tariffs are bad for your business. Right now, the way markets seem to be pricing this in, they seem to believe the positive stuff is more likely to happen, to be more thoroughly executed, and that the bad stuff, the risky stuff, is going to be more haphazard and not as fully executed. Is that right? Well, I don't know. That's being based on – that's a judgment based on little glimmers of evidence, not on kind of hard policies or decisive evidence. So that could change on a dime, but that seems to be the judgment in financial markets so
far. In other
words,
they're not believing that Donald Trump will go to trade war at the moment.
Right. They think he will, you know, obviously take a more aggressive stance in negotiations and try and get some changes around the edges, but not risk a very disruptive thing that really undermines the entire structure of the modern global economy.
4 years from now, do you see the people at the Carrier air conditioning plant and other factories in the upper Midwest that swung to Donald Trump, do you see them feeling a different economy under their feet, Neil?
It's possible. You know, we've been wanting to see a stronger pace of growth for some time, and if these policies get implemented, there could be faster growth in the next couple of years. It might come at a cost, though.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economy and Donald J. Trump, the president-elect who ran on jobs and big growth, looking at what it would take, what he may try to deliver. What do you see coming? Will Republicans support huge infrastructure fiscal stimulus under Trump that they would not under President Obama? What do you see coming on taxes, trade, manufacturing, Wall Street? Throughout his campaign for president, he talked about against trade deals like NAFTA, the TPP. Here he was again, September, Economic Club of New York. He was saying he'd renegotiate or terminate NAFTA if elected.
We will entirely renegotiate NAFTA into a deal that will either be a good one for us as a country and for our worker, or we will terminate it until a brand new and productive deal can be signed.
And how good is the economic plan in his victory speech last Wednesday? Really great, he said.
We have a great economic plan. We will double our growth and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world.
Last night with Leslie Stahl on CBS 60 Minutes, three things he wants to happen right away.
There was health care, there was immigration, and there was a major tax bill lowering taxes in this country. We're going to substantially simplify and lower the taxes.
And you've got both houses.
And I have both houses, and we have the presidency. So we can do things
you
that
can
are
do things lickety
been a long time since it's happened.
Neil Irwin is with us from the New York Times, senior economic correspondent there. Joining us right now as well from Washington, Robert Scott, senior economist, director of trade and manufacturing policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. Robert Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we have with us from the University of Maryland, economist, professor of international business, University of Maryland, Peter Morici. Peter Morici, thank you very much for being here today.
Nice to be with you.
What's the heart of it to your mind? What's the switch that Donald Trump can flip or the switches that you think may put the economy on a different track?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that we have been in low gear through two presidencies, both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. The financial crisis was an enormous aberration, largely set in motion by the regulatory forces from the Clinton administration when we got rid of Glass-Steagall and didn't put in necessary safeguards. I think that in the wake of the financial crisis, there was an overreaction. We certainly need to regulate banks differently. We need to look at banks differently than we have in the past. And Dodd-Frank has done too much and too many things wrong. And I think it's emblematic of a lot of the regulations that have come out of Washington. I don't expect, and we're already hearing it from the Trump people now, or the prospective Trump people, as we look at their backgrounds and what they think we think they would do, is we're going to peel away part of that kind of stuff, but not all of it, and replace it with other stuff. My feeling is we ought to get rid of that. We ought to get rid of Dodd-Frank, but also reimpose some modern version of Glass-Steagall and break up the banks. But that's not going to happen.
Peter, why will that bring jobs back? I mean, during those years of freewheeling deregulation, as you well know, the deindustrialization of America went on pretty swiftly.
Well, hold on. Freewheeling deregulation began in the Carter administration with the breakup of Ma Bell and the deregulation of the airlines, and it came forward from there. We can pick what period we like. There are a lot of variables and a lot of moving parts.
My point is just that the Wall Street thing that I will hold on, but I want to make the question clear. The deindustrialization has happened for decades. I'm not pinning it on any one administration, but it's a time when Wall Street was getting more and more free, and deindustrialization just continued. We saw it year after year. So how does loosening up again now help us bring jobs back, Peter?
Well, my feeling is we've gone too far with deindustrialization. There's a lot of manufacturing going on in China that should be going on here. That doesn't mean we're going to bring back all the jobs that we had in 1970, because we have had a lot of productivity growth. But productivity growth, automation, have been a continuing theme in American life since the cotton gin. And we're going to continue to have that happen, so we have to create new industries and new jobs. To do that, we have to have banks that make loans. And unfortunately, it's become very, very difficult for smaller banks to do business, and that's often where entrepreneurs go. So one aspect of the Trump presidency will be to take a hard look at regulation and try to get it right. I think there's been, in the wake of the financial crisis, they've gone too far in many places. And now we need to scale it back, but not get rid of it. With regard to health care, we spend about 50% more than the Germans do on health care, and that is a burden that American business has to carry. It's a competitive burden. One way or another, you have to pay for it. You pay for it, part of it through taxes, part of it through direct payment, but you got to pay for it. Getting health care in line, that would help create jobs by making American companies more competitive. We have very high marginal corporate tax rates. Some companies are very good at dodging those taxes, and they're not that much of a consequence to them. Others are not. Depends on what kind of business you're in. My feeling is, corporate tax reform is something that's sorely needed. There's a lot of Democrats that think that, as well as Republicans. The Obama administration was bent on always trying to find more revenue for yet more social programs, so we couldn't have it while he was in office, because if you want to get more revenue out of tax reform, you're just not going to have it. So I think that would help. With regard to China, our imports from China exceed our exports by a ratio of 4-1. The whole theory of free trade is that you export as much as you import. And this whopping $400 billion deficit, if we could get rid of it by making some more things here, but also by exporting more, we would create more jobs. It's silly to think that we wouldn't. We have a lot of slack labor in the economy. We have 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 54 who are neither looking for a job nor employed. They're so discouraged they don't leave their houses during the day. We need to do something about them. Now, that's not going to solve all of our problems, because some of our problems relate to the fact that a lot of people that are underemployed really aren't underemployed because they're not properly trained.
Yep.
The education system hasn't worked very well. That has to be addressed. But not everything will be addressed by the Trump administration. Some of this, if you create new opportunities, has to be addressed by the states, because that's where some of this stuff goes on. But I think if you look at getting taxes right, getting regulation right, getting trade policy right, this economy will grow faster. You know, Barack Obama himself said the undervalued yuan was slowing growth in the United States. He said that eyeball to eyeball with the president of China early in his presidency. He campaigned on doing the very same things that Donald Trump campaigned on, the very same things when it comes to trade. He looked at him eyeball to eyeball at the UN and says, something's wrong here. If you don't do something about it, I can. The president of China looked back at him and did nothing. And Barack Obama did the same. The real key here would be, does Donald Trump have the courage of his convictions and to press the Chinese to finally do something? Barack Obama was unwilling to do it. The question is, will Trump go where Obama failed to go?
Peter Maurici, stand by. Let me take it to Rob Scott, and I thank you for that opening there. Robert Scott, how about it? Deregulation, corporate tax changes, figure out health care. I mean, the costs have been brought down some under Obama, but that's a big challenge right there. Do you see in all this a surge back to the United States, or somehow, you know, organically produced in the United States of the kind of jobs whose loss has been critical to the Trump victory? Are they headed home? Are they headed, you know, are we headed to some kind of manufacturing, blue-collar job renaissance, Robert?
I haven't heard the pieces put on the table yet that are going to make that happen. I think that certainly some of the elements are there. The idea of a massive program of investment in infrastructure, perhaps as much as $1 trillion or more, is central to building demand in the economy. And some of that demand would support a growth in output from the manufacturing sector, okay, steel, concrete, machinery, and so on.
Yep.
So that would be a good thing. But I think a lot depends on how you finance it. If it's financed through the private sector, or if it's financed by cutting other forms of government spending, it's not going to stimulate the economy. So are we going to raise net demand in the economy that's going to spill over and benefit the manufacturing sector? That's a key question. Another key issue that we didn't hear anything about from Peter was unfair trade. And this is a huge issue. China has massive amounts of
I think we heard a lot about
capacity.
It from Peter, but can it be changed?
Yeah, I think it can be. I think we have to go to China and talk to them about reducing excess capacity in steel and aluminum and half a dozen other industries where they've been dumping products for years.
And we've been talking about it for years. What's different here? Do you hold the cudgel of trade war before them, 45% tariffs? Does that work?
I think that's too far. I think we use very specific tariffs in specific industries where they have been found guilty of dumping. And we've done this in the past. We can do it again. We can go to broader trade measures. Trump and his trade policy has mentioned the use of what's called 301, which would be an industry-wide tax, for example, on imports of steel that would be put in place temporarily to encourage the Chinese to get rid of some of this excess capacity. So I think that is critical to stabilizing demand for American-made products. But in the end, we have to rebuild demand. And so the third piece of that is, as Peter suggests, I think we have to act on exchange rates. I haven't seen proposals yet for how we would do that. Naming China a currency manipulator, which is one thing that is mentioned by the Trump administration, is not by itself going to force China to revalue its currency, or for that matter, other countries that are manipulating their currency.
And if they're kept too low, it gives them a competitive advantage that the U.S. manufacturers can't compete with, you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, we have a growing problem of surging trade surpluses and surging saving surpluses, something we haven't talked about. There is this so-called phenomenon of the savings glut.
In China, in Japan.
It's not just in China. It's throughout East Asia. Mm-hmm. And it is pushing up. It's going to tend to push up the trade deficit unless we do something to offset it and persuade the Chinese and the Korean and Japanese that they need to spend more and save less. So these are key issues that we haven't talked about.
But do you see a way out of this, some people call the secular slump here, that there's a structural problem that is limiting American growth? Donald Trump says he's going to bring jobs back like crazy, will double our rate of growth, which is what, under 2% now. Do you see that in somewhere in this Trump recipe, as vague as it remains at this point?
I think entirely depends. If Trump goes the route of raising tariffs on a across-the-board basis on imports from Mexico or China, I think we do risk running into a trade war. And I think research has shown that it's likely to shrink the economy. It's likely to lead to a recession. Could push unemployment up. On the other hand, if we can rebalance exchange rates and rebuild, that would rebuild demand for U.S. exports. And it could cause the economy to grow. I've published a paper that showed if we shrink the trade gap by anywhere between $200 and $500 billion, that can create between 2.3 and 5.8 million jobs and soak up some of those unemployed workers that Peter talked about. So I think it depends on how this strategy is executed. If we go the direction of raising tariffs alone, I think it's going to choke off demand and shrink the economy. If we rebalance global demand, then I think it could help.
Of course, that's been long, long talked about and very hard to do, but we'll see. Robert Scott, Peter Morici, Neil Irwin, stand by. Lots of callers for the three of you. Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, thank you. What I think is colored by my experience here in Wisconsin, we have a governor that campaigned on creating 250,000 jobs in his first term if elected.
Scott Walker there. Yeah.
When he was elected, he decided to cut taxes, gut environmental regulations, and try to undermine workers' rights through things like putting forward rigged elections for their unions. Because if more votes came in to keep the union, he would still bust it.
How'd it work out, Nate?
What? We end up having less economic growth and less increased jobs than most of the states neighboring us, including Minnesota, which has a Democratic governor and an ungerrymandered legislature. So I would say the infrastructure seems like the only way to actually create jobs. And the question then is if the small government Republicans, because this would be a big government project, decide to fight Trump, which would mean he would have to compromise with Democrats. Now, maybe their resistance to infrastructure spending is ideological, or maybe it's simply because they didn't want to help the economy under a president named Obama. But if Trump can do it, I think that is the only major way I see him creating jobs.
And then how long are those jobs? I mean, once the airports are built, what happens to those? It's not exactly like whole new industries being born there, but it could be jobs. Peter Morici, what about the Wisconsin example? And what about potential Republican resistance to the big infrastructure push?
Well, those are two different questions.
Yes.
They're very different.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the Wisconsin thing, my feeling is that governors get too much credit and too much blame for what happens inside their states, unless you're particularly obtuse, like the state of Maryland, which has really aggressive business regulations. Governments don't really affect how well states do relative to one another as much as, do you have oil underneath you? And
heard you say 5 minutes ago, a lot will depend on the states, and there was an example.
No. Hold on. I said certain issues would depend on the states.
Yeah.
One of them is training.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is getting job training right, getting education right, because that's largely a state thing. And it also has to be very responsive to the industries that come to you and to local conditions in that regard.
Right.
That's a very different thing. All right, but when you talk about deregulation and taxes, most of that stuff is really federal. You know, the states have corporate taxes, but the big corporate tax is the federal corporate tax.
But why would it be more effective if Donald Trump does it than when Scott Walker does it?
Because he's dealing with a much bigger impact. He's dealing with a much bigger tax.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of state taxes, income taxes and corporate taxes, are piggybacked on the federal structure. You know, it's an add-on.
Yep.
It's a little complicated, but that's basically what it comes down to.
And on infrastructure, do you think the GOP will go with it if he puts forward a huge plan?
Depends on how he wants to pay for it. My feeling is that there are some ways of paying for some of these things that don't involve some additional fees and taxes, but by and large, we're going to have to pay for them on the basis of who uses them. So if we want to build more highways, then we're going to have a bigger gas tax. Where we've tried to do toll roads, they run into a lot of resistance. And for example, the toll roads in Texas, some of those are in trouble. Some toll roads in Virginia where I live in the neighboring state to maintain my sanity. Also, my wife taught in Virginia. They've had some issues with some of the toll roads here. You can only go so far with those.
So can you get big infrastructure play if it's all like on a pay-to-play basis? You don't build anything that doesn't pay out on a toll or a new tax revenue stream?
Well, the thing is, you got to pay for it somehow, just about anything you want to do.
Well, deficits have done that for a long time. Would Republicans do that?
We have a deficit already that's pretty substantial, and the OMB, the Congressional Budget Office says it's going to jump a great deal more in the next decade, unless you're willing to cut entitlements. And there's some places where entitlements could be cut to no great damage.
Trump says he won't, basically. I mean, that hasn't been...
I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand. What I'm saying is that you have to pay for infrastructure, and to some extent you're going to have to do it with user fees of some kind.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economy and Donald J. Trump, the president-elect who ran on jobs and big growth. We're looking at what it would take, what he may try to deliver on very big promises. Robert Scott is with us from the Economic Policy Institute, Peter Morici from the University of Maryland, economist in both places there. Neil Irwin is with us, senior economic correspondent for the New York Times. You can join us as well. What do you see coming? Do you think good times are going to roll? Will Donald Trump help the people who voted him into office? Are you worried he'll run up a huge deficit? Will the GOP support him in that? Are you worried about trade war? Lots of comments online, on Twitter here. Benny says on Twitter, how do you bring back jobs from China when they pay their workers $3 an hour? Really? Come on. Seems like a con job, maybe. Ronan says from New York, in the middle of all this talk on the economy, I hear nothing about climate change, which has a huge impact on the economy. Fires, floods, storm damage, crop loss. Saying bring back coal is nonsense. There's been a lot of that. But Fungirl says all this naysaying is very close to what the experts, quote-unquote, said about Ronald Reagan. He transformed the moribund U.S. economy, crushed inflation, started 15 years of solid economic growth, Fungirl writes. Clinton, to his credit, kept it going with a little arm twisting. Go Trump is the word right there. A couple of callers, and I'll bring it to you, Peter, Rob, Neil, Rachel in Bozeman, Montana. Rachel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, I'm not that knowledgeable about economics, but from what I've read in the Wall Street Journal just yesterday, the way that I could see it is that if you have a family of four, you'll pay as much as 20% more on your taxes. And I just wanted someone to comment on that.
Neil Irwin, can you outline a little more deeply the impact of the tax cuts that Donald Trump is outlining? You described the far and away the biggest cuts for the wealthy. What about when you get to the middle and on down?
Yeah, it's so the overall thrust of the proposal is in the same direction and has some similarities to what House Republicans have been proposing for some time. He wants to cut the top income tax rate from the current 39.6% to 33%. Some cuts down in the middle range too. What I think the caller is referring to, there's some analysis by a professor at NYU that shows that because of the complicated way that a child tax deduction and the changes to deductions happen in this policy, it actually would result in higher taxes on some middle class families. That said, any kind of tax reform that happens, it will go through a grinding legislative process. There's latitude and there's space to try and fix those problems so the plan doesn't actually raise taxes. But that said, the thing to keep in mind, if they move forward, if congressional Republicans and the Trump administration move forward with what they say they want to do on individual income taxes, it will almost certainly mean a significantly lower tax rate on the wealthiest earners.
Neil, there's been a lot of bad-mouthing of trickle-down, which was, tacked on the Reagan years and more. Lately, we've got a lot of capital on the sidelines that hasn't been invested. Is there confidence among economists, if they know, and I don't know if they do, that cutting these top tax rates is going to release a surge of investment in new productive industries? Is the evidence there?
I mean, it's not there in the recent history. What happened in 2001 and 2003, George W. Bush did cut the top income tax rate, cut the capital gains tax rate. And it's hard to look at the economic data from the first decade of this century and see some enormous increase in investment. The things, even if you put aside the crisis and treat that as kind of off on its own, even before the crisis, corporate investment, some of the things you'd expect to see if that was creating a good supply side burst of growth, you don't really see that in the data from the 2000s. So I think that the recent evidence is not there that, just magically, if you cut tax rates on the wealthy, you'll get some remarkable surge in business investment. But that said, there are people and a lot of conservative economists who disagree with that and would say that that is the potential, that is the pathway forward to try and get stronger growth.
Peter Morici, why would that work more effectively under a Trump administration than under a W. Bush or the past decade? Is this trickle-down redux?
Well, I don't like the word trickle-down, and I always find it very emotive when it's used on me.
Used on you? I mean, people talk about the whole economy and
no,
presidents.
No. Well, the point is that when you talk about cutting taxes, oh, there we go again with trickle-down economics. The reality is the tax cuts worked very well for Ronald Reagan. They haven't worked well since.
Yeah, so what's up? Why would it be different?
Well, he did a lot of reforming of the tax structure and made it more reasonable and less complicated at the same time. That would be very useful. A lot of people are doing things just for the basis of beating taxes, including corporations that park money offshore.
$2 trillion.
There's that. But there's something else we have to deal with. Mm. And I want to point out here that, you know, I'm not here to defend Donald Trump. I'm not a Trump surrogate.
Go.
I'm a conservative economist trying to analyze what he's going to do and why it's good and why it's bad. One of the things that we are dealing with is not just productivity growth from the point of view of labor, but productivity growth from the point of view of capital. And that is, it took a lot less capital, that is physical investment, computer service and things of the like, to create Google than it did to create the Ford Motor Company.
Yeah.
A decade ago. So the point is that we can get a lot more bang out of a modest increase in capital investment from cutting taxes today than we could get out of it, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Why hasn't that shown up yet, Peter, in the last, let's say, 15 years?
Well, I think that part of the problem was the regulatory agenda that came along. George Bush was not a great deregulator. He was just a do-nothing guy. And Barack Obama kind of overreacted to the financial crisis. He's got these small banks tied up in knots. It's very hard to get an enterprise going. There are other structural problems also as well. We have a declining number of small businesses. The number of small business startups is very low, and part of that is the student debt overhang that a lot of these kids have. And of course, it's young people that start businesses.
Yep.
And part of it is the complexity of regulation. You know, one of the things you'll notice if you go from town to town is you see fewer restaurants that are owned by individuals these days. The reason is big operations know how to big franchises know how to handle local licensing requirements. They get good at it. They have legal departments for it. They have economies of scale at doing that. You know, I put a deck on my house a couple of years ago. I couldn't believe how much more complicated the city zoning requirements were than when I rehabilitated my house some 20 years prior to that. It was remarkable the number of bureaucrats that were running around here with clipboards, mostly to no effect. I'll give you a really good example of bureaucratic overreach. Recently, I wanted to combine two of my IRA accounts at Vanguard. It turns out one of them was in the name of Peter Morici Jr. The other was in the name of Peter G. Morici Jr. They both had the same Social Security number, so they were clearly identified as mine. The compliance and control people in the back room at Vanguard said, first you must change the name on the account.
Peter, are we going to get a new factory out of solving your problem? I mean, I hate that kind of problem. I get it.
What I'm getting at is even to put up a candle factory in Maryland, you create a great deal of bureaucratic hassle.
Yeah.
If you hassle the living heck out of people, they just don't do it.
Rob Scott, are you buying this? Cut the regulation and we'll have new factories all over the place, new jobs?
No, I'm sorry. I beg to differ.
Hang on a second, Peter. Hang on a second. Rob?
I think we have to go back. I think it's useful to go back and look at what happened under Ronald Reagan. I think there are two significant things that actually happened under Reagan that have not happened under Obama, did not happen under Bush. In response to the huge recession induced by Paul Volcker and the Fed in 1980 through 82.
Clamping down on inflation.
Which had cramped down on inflation. They were successful with that.
Yep.
But to get out of that recession, first Reagan tried tax cuts that didn't work. He had to deal with the Democratic Congress. They finally came to agreement to raise government spending, and there was a sustained increase in government spending that boosted demand in the economy, and that's what helped create Morning in America and all the job growth that he got him reelected.
And big deficit.
The second thing that he did was he negotiated an agreement with Japan and Germany to lower the value of the U.S. dollar and raise the value of those currencies, and that reduced our trade deficit. So he made progress on trade. He invested in the economy. The problem we've had in the last 8 years is that the Republican Congress has blocked any effort to increase government spending. The question now is, Is Trump going to be able to have a significant program to invest in infrastructure? Is he going to do anything to address unfair trade and exchange rates and create increased demand for manufactured products? It's that increased demand that will generate investment. We do need investments to economies to generate growth.
You mean consumer
productivity
demand.
Growth?
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
You mean consumer demand? You mean
not just consumer? Yes, demand. Consumer demand is what's going to bring forth business investment in the economy. So I think that's the pattern we'd like to see. And I think there are real questions as to whether or not they're going to have an actual plan for rebuilding manufacturing, rebuilding the economy in a way that stimulates demand for, amongst consumers and investors.
We've got a question right along those lines, perhaps. Dean in Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. It's more of a comment than a question.
Okay.
We are a post-industrial nation, and that did not happen overnight.
Yep.
It didn't happen a year ago or 8 years ago.
Yep.
I grew up in Lynn, Massachusetts, and there were shoe factories and canneries, and there were textile mills in other parts of New England. Those began migrating to non-union centers in the South 60 years ago. Lynn was already struggling in the mid-1950s with this, and I know that this is true of parts of the Midwest as well.
So what about now?
Now I'm driving on 95 North. I just went through Pawtucket, Rhode Island, where for the past 6 months they've been dismantling a factory. I see it every time I drive.
What about the Trump message, promises, expectations?
I think that we are looking at a lot of broken promises here and a lot of desperation from people who expected miracles. Look, I'm not saying that there may be different types of jobs in this country. I hope to God that there will be. But no one's going to wave a magic wand and bring back manufacturing to this country. Look, your experts have said it better than I can. We have had automation in line with globalization and trade agreements. We're just not going to see manufacturing jobs flood back to the United States. Will there be other type of jobs? Yes, I hope so. Whether Trump is the guy to do it, I don't know.
There's a get real call. Rob Scott, what about it? What's realistic here? I mean, you can have infrastructure spending, and that's great maybe, build up, you know, new airports and bridges and roads. But in the end, that's not a new industry exactly. That's not a new economic base. That will stimulate demand. Where's the new job base that's going to replace factories that our caller just doesn't believe are going to magically come home?
Well, I think there's no question factories today are more efficient than they were 20 years ago. But we lost a tremendous share of world export markets between 1997 and 2015. And if you look at other countries like Germany and like Japan, they still employ 20% of the labor force directly in a manufacturing industry.
Can we do that
about
again?
8%.
Can we do that?
And I think we can get closer. And
what industries to like making zipper factories, or what is it going to be?
I think it's going to be in machinery factories and in factories building airplanes, the things that we do well. And I think those industries create tremendous demand for high skill services and create good jobs. The problem with the economy over the last 8 years is we've been creating a lot of bad jobs in low wage service industries, and that's why the growth hasn't been widely shared.
Can I give you a tangible example?
Yeah.
Okay, automobiles. The accession agreement with China that permitted them to enter the WTO permits them to maintain a tariff on automobiles of about 25%. In addition, they have a lot of administrative barriers to the import of automobiles. So if you want to buy a BMW over there, they'll import that. But a Chevy, not so much. Yet one of the best-selling cars in China are Buicks. It makes much more sense to make them here than over there.
Why?
Do it better.
For them, why wouldn't they want to make them there if the company will do it and they're happy to have
the reason they want to do it over there is that we can't export over there because of the very high tariff.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, going in the other direction, we only have a 3% tariff.
Yeah.
That's an asymmetry that needs to be fixed. If you remove that tariff and revalue the currency and get rid of the administrative barriers, just, you know, you can send cars here, we can send cars there. You'd be surprised how many more cars we would be sending. Just like why do we make Boeings here instead of there? Because it makes sense to make them here. You know, the cost of labor is not everything. The exchange rate matters, subsidies matter, administrative barriers matter. You know, if you carry your reasoning of $3 an hour to the end of the earth, everything will be made in China. The trouble is, who would buy the stuff then? everybody else would be unemployed.
Yeah, we get that.
Trade is based on specialization.
How do you get them to agree to changing the balance, Peter? How do you get China to agree to changing the rules in a way that changed that?
You know, let's quote a liberal economist. Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate, New York Times. Before Paul, you know, Donald Trump did not originate the idea of telling China either revalue your currency or I'm going to impose a tariff. Mitt Romney ran on the same platform. But before that, who wrote a column suggesting we do the same thing? New York Times liberal economist Paul Krugman. I would go further. I think a tariff on goods is not enough. Basically, if we imposed a tax on currency conversion of dollar into yuan, such that it gave us the same exchange rate effectively that we would have if China revalued its currency according to the purchasing power parity as computed by the World Bank, an international organization, you know, which it uses to compute, you know, what GDP would be if currencies were fairly valued, that would essentially have the same price effect as them revaluing the currency. So basically, if they don't do it, we'll do it. Fred Bergsten at the Peterson Institute, a well-regarded mainstream, that he suggested currency market intervention. Barack Obama himself said there are things we can do, but he flinched. The real question here is, will Donald Trump have the courage of his conviction? You know, I bet you right now, if Hillary Clinton had won this election and was talking about doing the very same thing, Rob Scott would be saluting and signing up. Because I've worked with Rob, and we know that's the case, Rob. I don't think you'd have much trouble with Hillary Clinton suggesting
Peter,
that.
You love to fight. We're trying to understand. Neil, what are the odds we get out of this without a trade war or with great growth? What are the odds here? Neil?
I mean, look, there's a pathway here that can rebalance the global economy, that can create more manufacturing and construction jobs in the U.S., and that leaves us better off. But it's a more complex set of policy trade-offs than I think a lot of the campaign rhetoric would suggest.
Rob, what's your optimism setting on your Robometer here?
My hope is that Trump is able to actually work with both Democrats and Republicans to come up with an effective agenda for investing in infrastructure and for fighting unfair trade and for rebalancing currencies and trade in this economy.
Peter, last word to you. What's your optimism level? Got 5 seconds.
I feel it. He has to do it in a bipartisan way. He has to see cooperation across the aisle and mutual sacrifice. If we do that, we can win, but we have to start cooperating.
We'll see. Peter Morisi, University of Maryland, Rob Scott, Economic Policy Institute, Neil Irwin with the New York Times. Not a whole lot of cooperation in the last 8 years. We'll see what comes next. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.